Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Hugh Raffles, award-winning writer, who is also a professor of anthropology at the New School. And we're talking about his new book, The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. Hugh, welcome back to the show. We actually talked before about Encyclopedia, but this book is a very unique book. And I want to say that to the audience, that this is a book where, first of all, your writing counts. You're serious about the writing. So it's not just what the topic is, but the experience of reading it is very, very important. But it's also about a lot of different things. It's about deep time and human history, loss, especially loss personal and otherwise. How did this book start for you? I mean, when was the inclination to write this book?
Yeah, I started this book in some ways a very long time ago. I think, let me do that again. Is this okay to do so? Is this a continuous take?
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Okay. This took me about 10 years to write, so I was working on it for a long time. And it started after I finished my last book, which is a book about insects. I started, you know, really looking around for another topic. And I did fieldwork in China at that time. And it was that fieldwork was about people who trained crickets to fight. So it was very.
I remember that section of the book.
Yeah, exactly. And they, that was fantastic fieldwork. I loved it. I loved doing that. And but while I was there, I kept running into people who collected rocks. And, you know, there are sort of often these scholars' rocks that they're called here that people maybe keep on their desks or in a study or somewhere. And they're these very philosophical objects for a lot of people, also very commercial objects, but for a lot of people, these very philosophical objects that so people would really be able to talk about them and have very interesting things to say about them. And often it was about how these stones had been, you know, were sort of like models for life. These sort of like they didn't, you know, bend in the political winds, and they, you know, kept, they had a sort of like a moral center and all this sort of thing. So they're sort of like models of a way to be in life. And I hadn't really thought about rocks and stones like that before at all. And that's I think what got me started on that. And I sort of realized as well that, you know, there are all these connections. So one of them was that my sister actually who died about 25 years ago, used to live just underneath this very famous stone circle in Scotland. And I remember going there when I was a child, a teenager. And that started me then thinking about, you know, the connection between that place and these stones and the difficulty of understanding what life had been like, you know, 3,000, 4,000 years ago when those stones were built, the stone circle was built. And, you know, the difficulty of reconstructing that life was also sort of connected to the difficulty of even reconstructing what my relationship with my sister had been.
Right, right.
You know, in the time that, you know, trying to go back to that time and remembering what that had been like, because, you know, those memories get so changed over time. So it was sort of like a bunch of all these different things coming together, which were sort of the catalyst for the book, and then trying to sort through those really took a long time.
And it travels. I mean, you go to a lot of places in the northern hemisphere, especially the northern hemisphere, and it's always reading your book. It was always fascinating for me about what people, the people who didn't build the stone circles, but were there afterwards. Like what they thought about the stone circles and then how they used the stone circles themselves. And then, as is usual with your writing, which I always love, there's always these sort of weird little digression stories that are just strange. It's like in the chapters about the Neolithic standing stones, you have this story about John Gow, the pirate who was hung twice.
Yes. Yeah, he was. It's a great story. And he did it with so much, you know, the accounts that I've read anyway, he did it with so much style. You know,
right. Yeah. If you're going to get hung twice, style is important.
I think so, yeah. So the rope broke the first time, and then he just, you know, he just made his way back up there again and put the noose over his own neck. You know,
see, that's
the story that comes down, you know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And then there were certain stones that were later people actually just made all this about, like the Odin stone. What a strange stone. Talk about that one stone. I mean,
and that's the connection with John Gow, because that was a stone in Orkney that had a hole in it. It doesn't exist anymore because it was destroyed by a farmer who wanted to get it off his land. But at the time, or for a long time, it was very, very important to people who lived on the island. It was somewhere that people would go to for, you know, just because they felt that it had health-giving properties. They would go there to, and this is the John Gow connection, because he was a pirate who arrived in Orkney and, you know, had a relationship with a woman who lived there. And they, I don't know what the word, be betrothed through the hole. They, you know,
I know. I was trying to imagine. So you actually stuck your hand through the hole?
I think so, yeah. And the way it was is people, you know, this is the way people talk about it, that you know, people would pass a coin through the hole as a sort of token of connection. And then the only way to get out of that relationship once you'd established it was with another handshake, you know, by touching that person's hand. So this woman, Mary Gordon, came down to London after John Gow had been hanged to touch his hand, but he was at the time, you know, on a gibbet in the Thames getting whatever they did to pirates at the time when they caught them, which was pretty rough. So the story is that she then went down to the Thames, touched his hand, and then went back up to Orkney and was freed in that way from the relationship and could have more relationships. But, you know, there are other versions of the story where she just actually sat up in Orkney and had somebody else come down and do that for her. And at this point, it's impossible to know.
But this gets to the heart of the book. I mean, there's this weird thing where people find these stones and they make a whole thing about them. There's stories about them, and even if they're incorrect. Or from the other end, you were talking about the farmer who just wanted to get the stone off of his property. So it's like it's an annoyance. So there's no like thinking, well, this could be an important historical or prehistorical monument. It's this weird relationship that we have with these minerals, and they're just there. They're not thinking anything. They're not doing anything. We're just putting our own sort of actions and ideas on top of the stones.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, that, you know, stone is really inscrutable and enigmatic. But what it does is it forces this reaction. And one of the things that we do around it is just create all this narrative and all these stories around it. And so as a, you know, as an object to write about, it sort of, for me anyway, became this way into almost like a story generating machine. It just like became this way into thinking about these time periods and these histories and these events, and just looking at everything that happens, sometimes because of the stone, sometimes despite it, you know, but that all happened around it, sort of, you know, like adjacent to it. And sometimes, you know, just looking at what happens to, oh, I don't know, like something like Micah. I mean, I have this story in the book about, which is another family story about my great aunt, who was in Theresienstadt, you know, the concentration camp. And in Theresienstadt, they had a factory where almost exclusively women in the camp would cut mica for the Nazi war effort. It was used by the Luftwaffe as a sort of generally as an insulator in equipment and planes. And they so women worked in this factory under, you know, as you would imagine, under horrific conditions. But thinking about the mica, then if you start with the mica, it sort of like opens up this whole world of what life was like in the camp, and also lets you also think about, you know, the economics of the concentration camps, which I think we don't often think about. And also actually the inefficiency and chaos of them as well. You know, we have this idea of them being, you know, and of the Nazis being this incredibly organized, functional, efficient, process that they were doing in military military bureaucratic regime. A lot of it, especially in the camps, was incredibly chaotic and disorganized, and it was sort of ad hoc, and they were just like responding, partly because there was so much brutality in there, I think, as well.
That was an unusual. I mean, first of all, the cutting of the mica, you had to cut it incredibly thin.
Yeah.
And so it was this incredibly labor-intensive work that they had them doing. And mica is a funny thing, because you see mica, little bits of it, in granite stones, granitic stones, I think, around here. And it's always sort of, you know, you get these little sparkles on it and stuff like that, and you don't realize that it could be connected with something like, you know, a concentration camp in Theresienstadt.
No, absolutely. And you also don't think that, you know, now it's used a lot in eyeshadow and other, you know, cosmetics. And you don't
to give it glitter? Is it to give?
Yeah, exactly. And you don't think of the conditions in which it's mined. A lot of that comes from India and is mined by women and children processed. So, and you don't think about that either. So, I mean, I think really paying attention to these objects and these substances, it gets you a long way into sort of like, you know, uncovering and excavating the world, you know. That's very much that kind of process for me.
One of the oddest minerals in this book is blubberstone, which I had never heard of before.
Well, that's because I made up the word, I think.
That would explain it. But it's a great name and very apt.
Yeah, I was happy with that. You know, I was trying to capture this idea. So I should say, blubberstone, I use the word to describe the residue that's left on these beaches in Svalbard, which was Spitsbergen, in the, you know, far northern island. And it's, you know, it was the residue of the whaling industry in the 18th century. And what you have is on these beaches, you just have this black material, often in the shape of the cauldrons that we use to render the oil, the whale oil, the blubber. And it's a mixture of gravel, blubber, and coal, probably, or sometimes wood. That's just sort of concretized into a rock.
What's interesting about it, though, is that in fact it's a testimony to the incredible slaughter of wildlife that happened in that area. I mean, there at one point you were describing how many creatures were just slaughtered, whales and seals and all sorts of things. And this blubberstone is there as this sort of strange new fossil remembering that.
Exactly. And it's really an amazing history, because they were, you know, the archipelago was uninhabited, and it was also very, very, you know, because the conditions are so bad up there, way up in the Arctic Circle, so bad there for human life, that people didn't overwinter there, really, until the coal industry came right at the end of the 19th century. Very few people would overwinter. Some hunters managed to, but it was rare. And so what you had was these industries, the extractive industries that would come and basically take out all the animals they could and move from animal to animal. So starting with walruses, then moving to whales and seals and eider ducks, and, you know, just all the way through until the animals just were pretty much completely gone. If you go there now, there's really very few animals up there. There's quite a lot of polar bears, and there's some beluga whales, but, you know, that have come back, but nothing to be, you know, the level of amount that there was a couple of hundred years ago. And then people moved on to coal. It moved into, became a site for coal extraction. But mostly now it's because it's strategically important for the, you know, especially with climate change, as a gateway to the Arctic and to the Northern Oceans and the route across to the Pacific. So coal is there because Norway and, you know, the sort of NATO through Norway and Russia want to maintain a strategic footprint there, so that they have some, you know, they have some presence, you know, for the time when the ocean completely opens up.
Well, then it becomes a dark symbol of the way humans have used the planet.
It really, yeah, too dark, really, isn't it? I know, it really is.
It was really amazing. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Hugh Raffles, award-winning writer, who's also a professor of anthropology at the New School. And we're talking about his new book. It is a wonderful read. The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. I've got to ask you, and I should have asked you right off, what is an unconformity?
Well, you know, unconformity is a gap in the geological record. It's a geological term, and it's the point at which two layers from different non-sequential time periods meet. So, you know, and the gap could be huge. There could be, you know, millions and millions of years in between. So you can, it's basically a hole in time or a hole in the record of time. So for me, not being a geologist, it became more a matter for.
Yeah.
You know, it opened up this question of, you know, like, what's missing from between them? And it just became this site that generated, you know, speculation and imagination. In the same way that I think, you know, geology and archaeology and history as well, you have this material to work with, and this, whatever it might be, the, you know, the data that you're working with, but so much of creating a story out of that is speculative and imaginative and, you know, trying to ground it as much as possible in the data that you have and the material that you have. But still, there's always this element, of imagination. And the further and more remote time gets, you know, the more imagination and speculation is required, really, and more difficult it gets to fill in those gaps and those holes.
For me, one of the sort of most, I don't know if I want to say shocking, but it was a chapter that really made me sort of shook me, was the chapter about iron, about exploring the Arctic, looking for the meteorites, the Hiawatha meteorite. I think it's,
yeah.
And you know, I knew that the large meteorites had come from the Arctic area. What I didn't realize was the whole story of the relationship of the voyagers, the explorers, and their relationship with the endemic people, the Inuits or whatever the people were, how they were used by the explorers. And that was shocking. Did you know that beforehand?
No, I didn't know that. I knew a little bit of it, but I didn't know that. And in fact, you know, I live in New York City, and I would often go to the Museum of Natural History. I was very familiar with the Museum of Natural History and the museum. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that story. I mean, the two particular meteorites, or three particular meteorites that came back from Northwest Greenland. So no, I didn't know that story. I live in New York City, and I, you know, often go to the Museum of Natural History here, so I was familiar with the three meteorites that came back from Northwest Greenland. But I didn't know the context for it, and the story isn't reported in the museum except in the most, you know, the most casual way, really, saying who brought them back. But when I became interested in that, so I did two things really for that chapter. One was to go to Greenland and talk to people in the area that the meteorites came from, and to visit the site that they came from. And the other was to spend a lot of time in the archives at the museum. So although the chapter is really about Greenland and what happened, in some ways it's more about the museum and the conditions that allowed that type of exploration to happen and that exploitation to happen there. And the story is much, much more complicated.
It's got some interesting again, digressions. The story about Matthew Henson, the black Arctic explorer. I'm sure most people don't even know his name.
Yeah, and I mean, he really was the first. There are so many questions about this. So it was generally thought for a long time that Robert Peary, who was this a celebrity at the Avalanche at the time, which was around probably like the 1890s to 1915, something like that, was the first person to reach the North Pole. He went with Matthew Henson. He was very, very dependent on Matthew Henson, who was African-American. They worked together for a long time. And they actually arrived together at the North Pole. There's a lot of questions as to whether they actually made it there. Look, Piri wouldn't have got to them at all. By the time they were on this trip, he was disabled from frostbite, and Piri was really the person who was just making sure that he could, you know, be on a sled and get pushed and dragged there. The whole thing is just very, very sort of nightmarish, actually. And as well as that, there were four Inuit men who went with them to the North Pole and acted as their guides and, you know, provided them with all their knowledge of the Arctic, which made it possible, the Arctic conditions that made it possible for them both to do that journey. For people who live in that region, the North Pole is it's nowhere that anybody would ever want to go, because it isn't really a place, you know, it's sort of this completely emotional place. There's no reason for people to go, because actually it's just a completely sort of extremely dangerous folly to want to go somewhere like that. But for Piri, it was crucial because, you know, there was the real opportunity for celebrity and also for money by doing that. And so his whole career was really organized around more and more extreme attempts to get himself attention and sponsorship and fame. And then all these other people get caught up in that, get caught up in his project. And back in New York, there are all these people connected with the museum for whom Piri becomes this symbol, really a symbol of white America and a symbol of masculine America.
Yeah.
At a time when, you know, the U.S. is very anxious about immigration, a lot of immigration from, you know, Southern Europe and Eastern Europe, Jews from Eastern Europe. And so there's all this anxiety about that. You also have all the, you know, the early immigration controls coming in, you know, the rise of eugenics and white supremacy. I mean, it was funny, not funny at all. It was very disturbing writing this during the Trump years.
Oh, yeah.
When these issues were so front and center. And seeing the continuity in this, you know, in this history of white supremacy in the U.S. And the way it was playing out at that time and then coming back, not that it ever went away in some ways, but the way that it was sort of like foregrounded at these different periods.
You begin every section with a quote, and the one to this one, which was done by a native person of the area, and I don't think I could pronounce his name, Ka'ak Kut Siak Ita, or something. Can you pronounce that?
I don't even try. It was really difficult. You know, when I was in Greenland, I would say people's name and always get corrected, and what I was being corrected by was nearly always something that I just didn't even recognize it. Made me feel really, really, really pathetic. So
yeah, but that's like Hungarian. Hungarian's the same way too. But the quote was, "I remember it all. I did not forget anything because I never learned how to read and write."
Yeah.
And that was a powerful quote. That was very, very powerful.
Yeah, I've thought about that a lot, especially as somebody who writes and whose whole life is based on reading and writing in lots of ways. It is really powerful. It's in the town of Kanak in northwest Greenland, and I told the story of how people were relocated to that town in the 1950s from after they were evicted from an area which gets taken over for a U.S. air base up there. There's a small museum in the town. It's a beautiful small museum in the town that tells the story of how, you know, has a lot of information about how people live in the area, but also tells the story of the evictions and also of these meteorites. And that's the sign. Actually, the quote there is a photograph of the sign that hangs above the door just inside the museum. And yeah, it's very fascinating to me. It really makes you think about the relationship between writing and memory. And we tend to think about writing as something, you know, writing as a way to archive memory and to solidify it and make sure that things aren't forgotten. But it's also a way to determine what that memory is and to narrativize it in a way that means that, you know, narrate it in a way that means that certain things get excluded, the stories sort of and the history sediments and gets caught in a particular way, so that other interpretations get lost over time as it gets simplified and clarified, I suppose.
Funny because I remember I did an interview some years ago with an expert about ancient Greek literature, and he said he'd written that originally the ancient Greeks were against writing the epic poems and all the material down. They thought that was bad, that you should keep it in your head and tell it. And that reminded me of that same element. I mean, the fact that once you write it down, you're right, it becomes one version, and that's only the version that gets passed on then from that point on. And so all the other input and the different versions of that one story get lost.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I didn't know that about.
Yeah, they didn't like writing originally. They thought it was a bad thing to write all that stuff down, and they had different reasons for it. Part of it is that you got to put some of yourself in it when you were telling the story, and then it became a very personal tale. We're almost completely out of time, there's so many characters in here to talk about, including William Stuckley, who called himself Chindanax, the arch druid, but ended up becoming the first secretary of antiquities in the 1700s.
He's fascinating.
Well, you pass through these characters in this book that actually entire volumes could be written just about this. Like, I wanted to read an entire book about John Gow.
I know.
And then William Stuckley. And then in New York, locally, there was the Princess Naomi Kennedy, who I found her absolutely fascinating.
And it's so hard to find out any information about her at all.
Really?
I was in touch with one of her relatives who let me use that photograph of the that's in the book. But it's really hard to find anything. I mean, some things from local newspaper reports, newspaper reports at the time, but very, very little. But I imagine that somewhere, if you knew the right people, there would be people who have all kinds of stories about her, because she's such a larger-than-life figure. I mean, I should say she took over this, this sort of tourist
reservation
that was built in Inwood Hill Park in Echo, Manhattan.
We're completely out of time here.
Oh, that's a shame.
There's so much. The real pleasures of reading your writing is that it takes these digressions, that takes the reader into all weird little cubbyholes and corners and eddies of history. But this is a powerful book, too, and a very emotional book. My returning guest tonight is Hugh Raffles, award-winning writer. He's also a professor of anthropology at the New School, but we're talking about his new book, The Book of Unconformities, Speculations on Lost Time. Hugh, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much, Mark. I really enjoyed talking.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.